Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're here. On today's show, we are focused on your taste buds and how they're connected through your brain to your sense of justice. So we've got hippie food and tipping etiquette coming up on the show. But first, who deserves to grow up here in our chilly waters? You see, in the middle of Puget Sound, off the shores of Cypress Island, are net pens filled with Atlantic salmon. This summer, one of the net pens collapsed, and thousands of these non-native salmon escaped. And now, lawmakers are deciding whether or not Washington should join Oregon and California and ban Atlantic salmon farms. Well, wait a second. How did Atlantic salmon get here in the first place? Here to tell you the story is the environment reporter for the Seattle Times. Welcome back, Linda Mapes.
Hi, Bill. Good to be with you.
We're not the Atlantic. Why do we have their fish?
Well, that's the question that everyone is asking these days. And you know, it all started back in the 1970s, the era of bad haircuts and tie-dye and all that.
We'll be talking about hippie food momentarily. Tie-dye might come up.
Go on. Just stay in the groove. Yeah. So, you know, this is a gift of a bunch of federal scientists at Manchester over there in Kitsap County, and Union Carbide and Swanson's, Campbell Soup, the people who brought us the TV dinner. So back in the 70s, the objective was to try to grow a perfectly pan-sized salmon. In fact, a little salmon that could just fit right in the slot of a TV dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually started out with Pacific salmon, coho. But what they quickly figured out was that these docile, domesticated Atlantic salmon were actually the perfect sea cow, if you were. Really, these are feedlot operations where you take lots and lots and lots of these animals and you contain them in what they call a flow-through net pen that sits right out there in the open water. And you put in the food and the fish sit there and they get nice and big and fat, and they're harvested typically at about 8 to 10 pounds and they go to market.
Why are Atlantic salmon more docile and domesticated than Pacific salmon?
Because Pacific salmon are still wild. You know, they don't have hundreds and hundreds of generations of farming as these Atlantic salmon do. And so Pacific salmon really don't lend themselves to this kind of net pen culture. They're too feisty. They don't fatten up in the same way. They're just not as suitable as Atlantics for domesticated farming operations. This is farming.
Well, why don't they keep their docile fish in the Atlantic and just truck them over here when they're ready? Why are they in the Pacific water? Why are they in Puget Sound?
They're in Puget Sound because we have what these farmers want. We have deep, clean, cold, fast currents, and we have coves. You mentioned California. You mentioned Oregon. They don't have the same suitable conditions that we have for net pen salmon farming. Alaska, by the way, also has banned Atlantic salmon farming. Washington is the only state on the U.S. West Coast that allows this industry. And Cook Aquaculture Pacific has only been here since 2016.
That's the company that lost that net pen.
It sure is. And they are based in Canada. They're very large. Their revenues last year were $2.5 billion. They've got 6,000 employees. They operate in six countries. So they've only got actually two operations in Washington. They've got Washington's operations, and they also have farms in Maine. They are the only Atlantic salmon farmer in the United States. And when they came here, the idea was expansion, that they could come to the only place that allows this industry, buy the existing nine pens, and ultimately grow the business here.
Why did that net pen collapse?
Well, collapsed because it was stuffed and loaded and packed with 110 tons of mussels and other sea life. You've got to relentlessly clean anything in the water. Any boater knows this. You know, if you don't scrape it, clean it, keep after it, you're going to have what's called a fouled bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay.
You do not want a fouled bottom.
You super do not, because if you want to go fast as a sailor, it's going to slow you down. And if you've got a net in the water and you let it become fouled, it enormously increases the force of drag, lateral forces. In any current, the strength of that force of drag can become quite violent, which is exactly what happened in this net pen.
It's like not pruning your fir tree. The wind will take it too. But different.
Yeah, way, way different.
Okay, forget that. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, though, says the risk of farming Atlantic salmon in Puget Sound is low. Are they lying?
They're not lying. It's low. That's not zero. There's a difference. And I would also say that the science in all this is quite thin. There's been very little money put into research on, well, what really happens when Atlantic salmon escape? We know next to nothing about this. There's only one researcher up in University of Victoria in BC, John Volpe, who has worked on this. In fact, he's even snorkeled around in Scatter Creek in Thurston County and seen Atlantic salmon swimming around there. And he's found self-sustaining runs of Atlantic salmon in BC rivers. But, you know, that's his research is about the only thing that's out there.
That was the concern. Could they establish themselves and compete with the wild Pacific
salmon? And it is still a concern. I mean, what this comes down to is this wonderful phrase that scientists have. It's called propagule pressure. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Keep seeding the environment with different age classes of these fish, little ones, big ones, adult ones, medium ones. Do it relentlessly year by year by year, either by leaks or by these dramatic escapes. And, you know, life will find a way, it is the concern. And here's the other thing. I was here in the 90s when we had some earlier escapes, actually even bigger than this. And it just wasn't, people didn't respond to it in the same catastrophic way. And I think I have a hunch why. You know, Puget Sound is not doing well. We're down to just 76 resident killer whales. We are continually hearing about the effects of climate change on salmon returns. You know, you have oceanographers going out and doing these troll samples out on the outer coast. And for the first time last year, when they brought up their nets looking for out-migrating Columbia River Chinook, you know what? They didn't find anything at all. The nets were absolutely empty. They thought maybe there was a hole. So they went further up the Washington coast. They finally started catching things. Wrong fish. Fish from other ecosystems, still left over from the blob.
But
that warm water mass.
Could we fine and police and up the standards on Cook aquaculture instead of shutting down their whole business here in the Sound?
Well, that's a possibility. It takes money. You know, it's one of the things that I learned when I was researching the story we had in the paper on Monday was how little power the state agencies actually even have with regard to this industry. I'll give you an example. After this big collapse at Cypress Island and all the outrage and the uproar, and we've got an ongoing state investigation of what exactly happened, Cook Aquaculture last October said, hey, you know, it's time to restock our pen at the south end of Bainbridge Island with 1 million more fish. And by the way, we want to restock our hatchery with 1.8 million more eggs fresh from Iceland. And the governor weighed in on that and said, hey, look, you know, you're under investigation. And his chief of staff said, you really want to do this? I don't think people are going to like that.
It was permitted.
But that's the thing. It's permitted, and it was within the business-as-usual permit. And so Cook insisted on business-as-usual, and the governor couldn't do anything about it, and neither could any of the state agencies. And so that, to me, really spoke volumes about the limited authority of the state as currently constituted with regard to this industry. And, you know, after the big escape, Hillary Franz, the commissioner of public lands, who has the leases by which these pens operate in our public waters, decided it was time to really go do a deep engineering dive on all the existing pens. Take a look, you know, look underwater, check out the moorings, really look at whether they're
isn't that the state regulator's job?
Well, you know, you gotta wonder if that currently in the lease authority, they're not. It's not written that way, you know, that, you know, every time this lease, every 2 years, you've got to get in there and look at this thing and report on it at your expense, by the way. Those leases aren't written that way now. And all those inspections, we paid for those. That was $456,000. That's more than double the lease fees paid by these fish farms in the prior year. So at this point, it's not a good deal for Washington. What are we getting out of it? It's an $8.5 million payroll, the regulatory costs, dealing with the spill and all that. We've paid for that. And Cook has also spent millions and millions of dollars trying to make it right since this happened. But there's a real sense that, you know, it's just too little too late. I mean, I've covered state government a long time. And after this investigation, which went on for 4 months, the agencies held a press conference. And they said something that I've never seen agencies say in the headline of a press release, that Cook was negligent. That's a big word. Not only that, they said the company misled the agencies and the public about how big this escape was, how many fish got away, and also why it happened.
We have 2 minutes left, Linda. The Cook Aquaculture is threatening to sue Washington. Do they have a case, a legitimate case?
You know, that's an interesting thing that just came up. This is a big threat they raised in a committee hearing. You know, a NAFTA case is a very big deal, right? We're talking about something that goes on in The Hague, and it costs millions and millions of dollars. And basically, the essence of the case is, you know, when you had these escapes back in the 1990s, you didn't try to take away a license. You're only doing this because we're a Canadian company. Well, Does it really work that way? Can you say that everything has to be the same as it was 10 years ago? You know, standards change, life changes, Puget Sound has changed, political standards have changed. I don't know. Is that a case? You'd have to ask somebody who makes a lot more money than me, but it's questionable.
Finally, Linda, the controversy over Atlantic salmon and Puget Sound, how much of this is about food safety and ecosystem health, and how much is about sentiment and PR?
You know what? I would put it more strongly than sentiment or PR. That sounds kind of trivial. I think it's about identity. I mean, people in Washington State see this as a place of wild salmon, big trees, clean water. It's not a place that they regard as being like just like anywhere else. It's a special place, and the animals that live here, the wild animals that live here, Puget Sound, Atlantic salmon just isn't part of that picture for a lot of people. I've heard from so many people, ordinary people, just calling up and saying, they just don't belong here.
Yeah, they don't belong here. And is that, does that feeling that they don't belong here, does that translate to our health and the health of our planet? Because I sometimes think us and them, too.
You know, culture matters. And I think this is part of culture. And Cook has dismissed a lot of this, saying, oh, that's just aesthetics and it's about science. Well, you know, life isn't only about science. And these are our public waters. And if the majority of people feel that this just isn't something they want in their public waters, they have a right to that.
Linda Mapes, the environment reporter for the Seattle Times, following the health of Puget Sound and now the case of the great Atlantic salmon escape of 2017 and maybe the shutting down of the industry here as the rest of the West Coast does. Linda, great to see you again. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Back with The Record on KUOW, we're going to continue with the food. We mentioned Atlantic salmon, and earlier we were talking tabbouleh and alfalfa sprouts. We're going to talk about whether so-called hippie food was a passing fad or an important part of your diet and should stay that way. Stay tuned. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. It used to be health food. It was a punchline.
I just had the homogenized bone meal, wheat germ, and a side order of glucose.
I'm sorry, madam, but glucose doesn't come with the wheat germ. I could let you have crotose.
Oh, I don't like crotose. Have you any fluorotose?
Not on Fridays. No fluorotose on Fridays. How about a nice dish of ceratose?
Right, I have ceratose with a birch bark dressing.
Certainly. Birch bark. One ceratose with birch bark dressing, and you, sir?
I'll have an elm tree on rye.
Sid Caesar there eating at a health food restaurant. Oh, hilarious. Johnny Carson used to joke about the California hippies eating the healthy wheat germ and the sprouts. And it was all very funny. And then I went to college, and it was time to buy my own groceries, and well, I wanted to be healthy. I wanted to be as healthy as a hippie, so I bought wheat germ, and this is the early 80s, sprinkled it on my yogurt, and I ate tofu and rice cakes. Today, I still eat yogurt, but it's sweeter and fattier than it used to be. I still eat tofu, but usually in my oily Thai food. So what happened to the hippie food trend? The carob and the alfalfa sprouts and textured vegetable protein, was that a tasteless puritanical fad that got co-opted by our industrial food complex? Or was it a legit food revolution that permanently changed the way you eat? I want to know, and luckily I have Jonathan Kaufman right here, former food writer for Seattle Weekly and the author of Hippie Food. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
Your story of the hippie food movement begins with fear.
It really does. You know, when I started off researching the origins of all of these foods, like, you know, wheat germ and brown rice and whole wheat bread, I thought it was all going to be about idealism, but really so much of it was about a fear. It was really a reaction that the baby boom generation had toward the industrialization of the food supply and realizing just how many chemicals were in their food. I mean, a lot of this movement was inspired by Rachel Carson's 1964 Silent Spring.
Silent Spring, yeah. And you ate that fear as a child.
I did. I ate all of that food that, you know, I write about is stuff that I grew up. And I had really sort of forgotten about it, almost abandoned it because I became a cook and then became a restaurant critic, you know, which is what I was doing at the Seattle Weekly. But it really was a visit to the Sunlight Cafe. That really made me think, oh, well, I have this huge, all this nostalgia around this food, you know, like the steamed vegetables with tahini sauce and, you know, nut burgers and soy burgers. And it made me think, well, a lot of this food seems to be disappearing. And then if it's disappearing, where did it come from? And since I grew up in a small town in Indiana in the 1970s, and my parents shopped at a co-op there, I wanted to know, like, how did it get from, you know, the hippie enclaves like Seattle and San Francisco to Indiana?
Yeah, because how did alfalfa sprouts become associated with the lefty coast?
Yeah.
You were eating it in Indiana.
Well, it you know, my mom had a little alfalfa sprout grower, like a little glass thing where she'd sprout all alfalfa seeds.
Nice.
But it turns out like a lot of those foods like wheat germ and carob and alfalfa sprouts come from Los Angeles and the Southern California health movement of the 1920s through the 1960s.
The 20s, that early.
Yeah. There was this, LA had raw foods restaurants starting in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, but their focus was on like these sort of fresh vegetables, uncooked foods. They were concerned with digestion and about like eating all of these vital foods in order to promote beauty.
Fertile eggs, was that part of that thing?
Definitely part of that. Yep.
Fertilized eggs, that was thought to be
more vital.
More vital.
And
yes.
They wouldn't even eat mineral salts because they felt like salt was devitalized. And so they had to have seaweed and Bragg's liquid amino acids.
Yes. I'm talking with Jonathan Kaufman, who's the author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And you said a lot of this came back to you at the Sunlight Cafe, where I've been many times here in North Seattle. What part does Seattle play in this movement?
I think Seattle was part of this. What was happening, you know, all along the West Coast. The West Coast was really on the forefront, as well as parts of New England and, you know, the upper Midwest, of really. Because they were counterculture destinations, I think people came here with their ideas, you know, and also traveled across the country. So sprouts would be picked up by somebody who was eating them in L.A. or San Francisco and then brought up to Seattle. But Seattle had a very, very active organic food movement, agriculture movement early on. It had a big co-op.
CCC, Natural Markets.
Mm-hmm. And it had a lot of cooperative enterprises and also vegetarian restaurants.
Yes. I think of hippie food. By the way, how do people feel about? I mean, hippie is a slur, isn't it,
right,
anymore? How do people feel about you calling your book hippie food?
I had a few people who wouldn't talk to me because I used that word,
wow.
And I got a couple lectures. But I think a lot of other people, even like Molly Katzen, who the author of Moosewood Cookbook, you know, she sort of embraced the term.
Yeah. I knew what you meant. So I think of hippie food as stuff white people like. But you mentioned tahini. I mean, I also learned about. I don't know if you include hummus in this, but I do, you know, and there was an Ayurvedic kind of tinge to some of the health food in the 70s, right? It wasn't, so what am I off in thinking of hippie food as a white thing?
Sure, yeah, well, you know, a bit to my sort of disappointment, it turned out to be largely a movement that was happening within white communities. And the United States was 87% white at that time. But it really was, there was a disconnect between even the white counterculture and communities of color at that time. But at the same time, the counterculture folks who were really adopting all of these new foods that they had never cooked with before, never heard of before, they were trying to find a way to make them palatable. And so they were kind of inspired by spiritual pursuits and interest in Indian spirituality, mm-hmm. but also in any flavors that were going to make this food taste a lot better.
What do you eat, Jonathan? What's your diet like?
My diet's pretty varied. I mean, I still go out at the San Francisco Chronicle, where I'm now a staff writer. I do go out a lot to eat, and so I'll eat everything. But my husband's vegetarian, and so we'll eat vegetarian at home.
But are you eating carob and alfalfa sprouts and textured vegetable protein or
none of those, but we definitely eat a lot of tofu and tempeh. It's sort of a modern version of hippie food in the sense that it's really vegetable driven, tends to have a lot of international flavors, but also is, you know, you know, it's not you know, meat and potatoes food at all.
Well, that's what I want to get at. You know, my opening question was sort of what happened to hippie food, because some of it seems to have mostly gone away. I don't hear about textured vegetable protein anymore. Maybe it's around. I'm sure you can get it. I'm sure you can buy it. But, you know, carob is, I don't find carob in that dish pretending to be chocolate as much as I used to.
Thank God.
But thank God you're not a carob fan.
Not a carob fan. I think anybody who grew up eating it, having it forced on them, is sort of traumatized by the experience.
Well, there you go. So there were some foods, it seems like we left them behind and we said, okay, that was actually gross. And then some foods, just, you know, who doesn't eat granola and yogurt and I eat brown. I never order white rice in a Seattle restaurant, you know. But then there are other things that seem like they got co-opted and probably mixed with a lot of sugar and fat and chemicals. So help me understand what is hippie food anymore, and how much does it still matter?
Sure. So I think, you know, a lot of the dishes, the specific dishes that we think of as hippie food, you know, that and that very brown, very hearty bean and whole grain oriented food went out of fashion, at least in restaurants. It did stick around, you know, among vegetarians, and it also lived on in co-ops and natural foods markets, which have been supplying all of these foods for now 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it lived on in the homes of people who were cooking it as a home cook. Cooking. But it also evolved in the sense that some of those, the less tasty of the natural foods like alfalfa sprouts and mm-hmm. carob went out of fashion. But those ideas of how we should be eating if we want to eat healthy food really stuck around. So white, you know, the whole wheat bread is now, it sells more than white bread in grocery stores.
Yeah.
And
I'm waiting for my kids to eat. If they won't eat it, it's no good if it's still in their lunchbox. But I'm trying to bring them into the whole wheat bread. That just seems like a staple to me. I would never buy sliced white bread.
Sure. And well, now that, you know, the USDA really adopted a lot of these ideas that were so fringe in 1970. I mean, half of our grains are supposed to be whole wheat, you know, or whole grains. And so even in schools today, school lunch, it's going to be all whole grains because yep. of that. The food, though, is lighter. It's brighter. We have a lot more access to a lot more products and ingredients than we did back in 1970. So I think it's a lot tastier as well.
So overall, we are eating better than in 1970.
I don't know that as a whole we're eating better, but I think this really valid pathway, a really valid alternative, if you want to eat more healthfully, more ecologically, in a way that's more ecologically sensitive, you have access to ingredients and dishes that allow you to do that.
We're getting some reaction on Twitter as we're talking with Jonathan Kaufman. Hippie Food is the name of the book, and we brought up carob. And L on Twitter says, I think I grew to love carob because it was the best thing in my dad's bag of trail mix.
I'm sorry.
That's really grading on a curve. Beth on Twitter says, my parents were total urban gardeners in the 80s before it was cool. We ate veggies from our garden all spring and summer. Can you tell, these are, things are hard to quantify, but can you tell how much urban gardening has been a passing fad, or how much it's one of those things that has just, you know, it's become a fabric of life. We do it way more than we ever did.
I didn't look specifically at urban gardening because it's had these ebbs and flows over the years. I mean, like victory gardening during World War II was
what was victory gardening?
It was so for folks dealing with rationing because of the war, we're encouraged to plant victory gardens and grow your own vegetables.
Yeah.
Right. So it's in some ways it's a resurgence of that, but I think that interest in escaping industrialized food and worry over chemical fertilizers and it drives people to want to take control of what they're eating, and part of that is growing your own food.
Aaron on Twitter says, my parents weren't hippies, but I was definitely traumatized by carob. Nothing bummed me out like going to the Froyo stand at Westlake Center and discovering that the chocolate chips so generously sprinkled over my yogurt was chalky nonsense. We really have a lot of traumatized people, I think. You seem to be one of them.
Yeah,
carob was tough on you.
Especially because I was born in 1971, and so all of these foods that my parents were adopting in the mid-70s were things that I had no choice over, and as they were pitched to me as being healthier, you know, right at a time when I wasn't making choices based on health. And so carob was like became the symbol of all the foods my friends were eating at school that I didn't have access to necessarily.
Do you think the economic boom in Seattle, where, as I said, you used to live, changes how we eat here? I would think it puts pressure on farmland. I mean, is this an important part of the Seattle eating story?
I think we're really going to see the big challenge over the next 10, 15 years, because the first generation of organic farmers who were buying land, you know, around the cities when land was cheap, I'm seeing this in both the Bay Area and I think the Puget Sound, are retiring, and they have to figure out how to transition their land. King County was very active in working to preserve a green belt, you know, farmland. So I think in some ways Seattle's a little better off than a lot of other areas. But, you know, farmland's become so expensive, especially organic farmland, and especially close to the cities, that's going to affect our farmers markets and the food we have ready access to.
Separate from the farmers markets and the co-ops, what is the state of healthy, natural, organic? There's so many terms here. You know, we could be right, vegetarian, vegan. The restaurant eating scene in Seattle, how does it compare now to when you left? Is that eating fading?
No, I think it's definitely, I think it's
the Globe is gone. I remember the Globe.
Mm-hmm. But there are also restaurants like Plum, you know, and Cafe Flora is still going strong.
Sure.
So I think there's so much interest in vegan food right now nationwide, and particularly along the West Coast. There are so many vegan restaurants or vegan options that are opening up for people.
There are a lot of vegan Thai restaurants in Seattle. I love Thai food, but it tastes oily and sometimes sugary to me. Is vegan Thai health food?
because of vegetables, maybe. I don't know that it's particularly Thai as well. You know,
yeah.
Sort of Thai American.
Yes, true. I'm talking with Jonathan Kaufman, who's the author of Hippie Food: How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And you're doing a reading tonight in West Seattle at the Westside School, 7:30.
That's right. I'll be in conversation with Rebecca Den, who's a contributor for the Seattle Times.
Yes, that's right. And Jonathan used to be a food writer, restaurant critic for Seattle Weekly. You're a staff writer for San Francisco Chronicle now. Mm-hmm. Finally, any health, hippie/health, back to the land, paleo, vegan. Again, the terms swim in my head. But what's the hippie food trend of today that you find interesting?
I'm fascinated by the gluten-free movement.
Yeah, there you go.
Because there is a real response to growing awareness of celiac disease. So we're becoming aware of people who can't eat wheat or rye or other grains that include gluten. But there's also this broader interest in avoiding gluten that has caused there's a surge of, I think, creativity around that. So we're working with all of these new flours and grains that we've never worked with before. You know, almond meal and coconut meal are available in supermarkets, and apple cider has become a great alternative to beer.
I made apple cider on Vashon Island.
That's amazing.
Which is a classic Seattle-ish thing to do.
I think it's just, I think all of these interests in new diets are what propels change in America. So I love seeing what's happening.
My opening question was whether hippie food was a chewy, tasteless, puritanical fad or more of a legit revolution. And Jonathan Kaufman's answer is right in the subtitle, A Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat, actually changed the way we eat. And a lot of this inspired him at the Sunlight Cafe here in Seattle. Thanks for writing about it and coming back to town.
Yep, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Kaufman, tonight at the Westside School in West Seattle at 7:30. And we're going to be back with the record and continuing on the food tip, tipping. Tipping etiquette now that Seattle pays a higher minimum wage. Stay tuned. KUOW is the record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I enjoyed that hippie food conversation. What was the last hippie food you ate, Tom?
Me?
Douglas? Yeah.
Well, I think the guy's in prison. I think I had a piece of Dave Seedloaf for breakfast this morning, so he's in prison, but that's okay.
David Hyde?
Hippies are killers now.
Really? Are you a hippie food guy, David?
Who is it? It's Seattle. There's a place on Orcas Island that serves like a hippie bowl.
Uh-huh.
Like the hippie bowl from back in the day. And back in the 70s or 80s,
yeah.
When I lived in Portland, a hippie bowl would have tasted really awful.
Mm-hmm.
Is my poke, and greens on brown rice, is that hippie food?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. Have you been to Eve in Fremont? They've got a great bowl, grain bowl, lot of good butter.
There you go.
That's, you know, grain bowl. Everyone's got a grain bowl now.
By the way, I'm talking with KUOW reporter David Hyde and Seattle restaurateur Tom Douglas, he of the Coconut Cream Pie and the Dahlia Lounge and a dozen other restaurants, a cooking school called the Hot Stove Society, and a line of tasty barbecue rubs.
And last time I saw you, you were slaving away at Cairo Radio.
That's so right. That's right. So, and so happy to be back and back with you.
You have that natural National Public Radio voice.
Yeah, it's more suited,
it's
don't
lovely.
You think?
Sexy.
Sexy is the word that I was thinking of as well. I get that a lot. So KOW reporter David Hyde, you were...
Why did she just vomit?
Yeah, our social media producer here didn't seem to agree with the sexy label, but each to their own.
Yes.
So we're here to help a KOW listener out, David Hyde.
Yes. We're answering your newsy questions. You can go to our website. It's kuow.org. And the question I'm working on this week is about...
It's about...
Tipping.
Yes, it's the tipping point. Here we go.
The capital of China.
Here's the question.
You know, I was always... under the impression that the reason that you need to tip service people, like if you're going out to a restaurant, is to sort of bring their income up to a normal hourly wage, because they otherwise their base pay from the restaurant is, you know, much below what a normal person would make, and so they're relying on that for their income. And then, but then I wondered, well, now that Seattle has instituted a $15 per hour minimum wage, do I still have to tip people in order to bring them up to a reasonable wage?
So this is KUW listener Derek Hansen, and he's tying his question to the $15 an hour minimum wage. But this is a question we've gotten from a lot of listeners, and it's kind of a national discussion right now. Should we do away with tipping? Not necessarily his framing, just that question. Is the old system of tipping that we've grown up with obsolete?
And before I ask Tom Douglas, I want to ask you, the listener, because I'm sure you have a story here, an opinion. Should we move on from tipping? If you, whether you're a server or a dishwasher or somebody who eats out once a month or every day, we'd like your opinion, your story about this. So we're at 206-543-5869. Again, that's 206-543-5869. What do you do about tipping? Tom Douglas, you made a change to tipping in your restaurants. Why was that?
A couple of years ago we did. A couple of reasons. One is that, you know, when the city pronounced this new minimum wage law, it was done on a two-tier basis. And so I am stuck in the large tier. And there's some misconception that just because you're a larger restaurant group, that somehow or another you have a lot more money.
That's so not true.
It's oddly, it's not true. It's funny. But so anyway, I'm just at a much different level, pay level, than my compatriots, which is why we went to the service charge instead of just raising our prices, because I couldn't compete in the marketplace in the same way.
You had to raise your minimum wage sooner.
Well, yes, and I still do. I'm still more than most of anybody under 500 employees. I'm still under that. Minimum wage, by the way, as of January 1st, is $15.45 an hour. So, for example... my good friend Terry Rotero, we do a lot of work together, have our own radio show together. You know, he pays much less per hour for every bartender, waiter, busser, and host than I do, because it's a traditionally tipped position, and that's just the way it is right now. And we have three or four more years of that.
So you instituted a 20% service charge.
But I also instituted $15 an hour for non-tipped employees 2 years before the city council decided to make it mandatory. So the big difference is, I felt like there was many things going on, but the big difference is, you know, back of the house is not a legally tipped position, right? You have to be forward facing to the customer.
Back of the house meaning you're
dishwashers,
cooking,
cooks,
washing
things
dishes,
like that. Yeah. Front of the house, where you face the customer, you're allowed to take tips, and that's a state law. I'm not sure if it's federal law.
Right?
Yeah, it's federal law.
Yeah.
So one of the things we did when we did the service charge, we felt like it covered many things. One is, you know, when you come to my restaurant and you have a bad piece of chicken, what do? You send it back to the kitchen and you don't want it on your bill and you get it taken off your bill, right?
Yeah, I holler loudly.
Yeah.
You've heard me.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's perfectly fine and reasonable. People should, if they're not happy with their food, send it back. In tipping, it was always a scenario where, God, you know, my waiter just wasn't quite on tonight. Should I give her 10%, 12%, 15%, or 20%? Well, frankly, in my opinion, if your waiter's not on tonight, you shouldn't give her anything. Mm. And not only that, but all the food she brought to your table, you shouldn't have to pay for it because you came for this. You know, you didn't come for a service experience and a food experience, a dining experience. You came for the whole package.
So you that's a case, making a case against your own service charge, isn't
no,
it?
No, it's not. What it's making a case is standing up behind our service charge. If you don't like your dinner, you don't pay for the chicken.
Okay.
You don't pay for the service. You don't pay for anything. And so it's not a matter of deciding when you've had a bottle of wine or two of what percentage you should leave this particular waiter. And believe me, when we see that you're not tipping the waiter or that we have to comp your whole dinner because your service wasn't there, we see the problem areas really quickly.
So how do your front of house people like this? How do you split it up, and how do the front of house people like it?
Well, right now it's a little bit like tipping as far as how we split it up. By law, we have to give 100% of the service charge right back to the people who earned it, right? So we don't keep a dime, not a nickel, not a penny. And we audit ourselves to make sure that that's the case. But we split it up. Right now they're on a commission, right? So when they achieve their best status, they make 14% of that 20% as a commission. If they're a brand new waiter, they might make only 12%, we'll say. I can't be super specific, but that's the idea, is that as you get your experience and as you earn the right, you get a higher percentage. Whatever is left of that pool is what we pay. It's called rev share, and that's what we pay our bussers and our bartenders and our hosts, forward-facing employees of the company. So...
Okay. And then
it's fairly simple and it's very much like tipping, and they are making approximately the same exact amount.
So one more question for now on that is because we're going to get to tipping, the customer experience. What do your customers say about how this is going?
Well, it's about what we thought. 80%, maybe 90% are perfectly fine with it. They're already 20% tippers. They don't really care. Some of the math is done for them. If they're not happy, they let us know. And we refund their meal, whatever it is. Where we have seen it is on online reviews, because some people aren't confident enough to have that conversation with the manager on duty at that night, or
that's not a pleasant conversation.
No, it's not. It's fine. And it's so. But we do see that in our reviews, especially from... Canada, it turns out, that we do see that sometimes. As far as the waiters go, I think they had a lot of trepidation in the beginning, and I think they're perfectly fine with it now. They're making the same or better than they were.
So just to be clear, does any of the tip pool get shared with the back of the house?
At this point, it's against the law. You have to be a forward-facing...
If it's service charge.
Correct. We had to raise the prices. It wasn't too much. We were already there.
So why not do what Danny Meyer did and just raise prices, and then... you can share accordingly.
Yeah, that would be awesome. He's still struggling with that. You know, New York didn't follow, and I'm struggling with that a little bit. Seattle really hasn't followed, and nor does the smaller operator have to follow at this point. I think it's going to be interesting the next couple of years when they have to start getting up to that final number, that 15, 45, or next year it'll be 16. But the point being is you can't go it alone. If I were to raise all my prices, my chicken price, people shop online, right? They go on and say, look at my menu, and they say, okay, his chicken is $35. Well, Terry Rotrow's chicken is only $28. Well, why is that? It's the same chicken. Because I'm including service. But you can't have that conversation with people at a concierge desk, online. It's just too difficult. It just looks like we're that much more expensive. And so that's why in this transition time, we think it would be awesome to go the Danny Meyer route long term.
So some restaurants also include a tip line. So they'll charge the 20% or the 15% or the 18% or whatever. And then there's also a tip line. Do you offer that as well?
Inscrutable. I think that's a terrible thing. And I think it's not that you shouldn't be able to give the staff person that you feel really took care of you tonight more money. We bump them a $10 bill, do whatever you want to do. But for me to put that kind of pressure on the customer after we just charge you 20% and then to leave a tip line there, I find that very annoying. And we don't do it in any of our restaurants.
So do get the reaction from some people that we're going to hear from today, hopefully, and are out there who just say, you know, Tom Douglas, you have robbed me of one of the pleasures of dining, which is which is the tipping experience. Yeah. I, for whatever reason, really love tipping, and you've taken that away from me.
Yeah, we hear it. We certainly hear it. And I don't know what to say to that other than most people don't feel the way that you do. And I think that it's a great equalizer. It doesn't matter what you look like. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It doesn't matter whether you need to make rent this month or not. The service charge is based on the service experience that you give.
I do want to ask specifically for someone to call in, because I want to take a call now. But if you love tipping, if you feel that way, tell me your story of what is fantastic about tipping. Our phone number is 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. And we have Robin from New Zealand. Are you in New Zealand, Robin?
I am in New Zealand right now, in the Bay of Plenty.
What's the New Zealand take on tipping?
Well, they don't. Culturally, they do not tip over here, and I don't know how long a situation that has been, but I've been coming to New Zealand for 25 years, and in 25 years, there's been no tipping. A couple places, they start to put out tip jars now, but essentially, if you go to a fine restaurant, you don't tip. The cafes, you don't tip. And you get really good service here.
Robin, I heard all of that. I heard your New Zealand tipping take. Your phone does sound a bit like you're in New Zealand, so I'm going to turn it over to our guest to comment to what Robin has to say. Mm-hmm. You travel a lot of places, you're not going to see tipping.
Well, that is not particularly true where I've traveled, but I do know, I understand New Zealand, they have close to a $20 minimum wage. I am all for the higher minimum wage. There is just... there's just no way around it. The area where sometimes I get branded as being anti-minimum wage was that I didn't feel like, I mean, waiters make tips. In the past, the waiters have to pay their taxes on their tips. They have to declare them. If they don't declare them, I have to pay their taxes on their tips. I pay labor and industries. I pay Social Security tax on their tips. To me, they were a wage. And where we disagreed as a community and as a state is whether tips were wages. And that's what Ms. Sawant disagreed with me on. And that's why she brands me as being anti-minimum wage. The former mayor branded me the same way. Nonsense. I am for minimum wage. Who can live on $15 an hour? It is so difficult, especially in this town. And so... I really believe that minimum wage is a good thing for our communities, and I'm sure that's going to be unpopular with many listeners, but that's how I believe.
That's Seattle restaurateur Tom Douglas, and we have KUOW reporter David Hyde here as well, who's covering this story. We're answering your tip questions. Let's take another phone call then. It's Joey in Greenwood. Hi, Joey.
Hello.
Hi. What's your tipping story, and how do you feel about tipping? What do you do, and what do you want?
I think I've worked in the restaurant industry before in the Seattle area, so I do know the cost of living versus what they pay hourly and how much those tips really mean to servers. But I would like to see the hourly transition into just a livable wage, just like your listener from New Zealand said, because they have a livable hourly wage, they don't have to depend on tips. They just deserve a livable wage because they work hard, and they keep their jobs because they need to keep their jobs. You know, they do a good job, so they need to keep it. So I'd like just the cost of paying a livable wage to servers put into the actual cost of the food. If restaurants need to raise their prices in order to pay their servers a livable wage and not depend on tips, then that's what they need to do, because we do our job because we want to keep our job. You know, I get great service regardless of how much the tip is.
Joey in Greenwood agreeing across the ocean with Robin in New Zealand. Thank you, Joey. You
know, and with me, by the way. I think that's a great comment, and I think that's the ultimate. That's where we want to be when everyone is on the same playing field, and that everything can be included in the price of your chicken. That's the ultimate.
But you know, the listener who contacted KUOW, Derek Hansen, thinks that tipping puts an unfair burden on him as a customer.
Deciding how much I have to pay and how much they have to pay the worker, you know, how much the staff should make is a business function that is incumbent on the business to perform. It's not a burden that should be placed on me as the customer.
Yeah, so what this guy is saying, right, is that essentially the way it works in restaurants traditionally without the service fee is that you're asking the servers to act as sort of mini managers out there.
Of their section or
their table and mm-hmm. decide, you know, this employee deserves this amount of money or that amount of money. It's too much of a burden, he says. That should be on the restaurateur. I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, I think I just said it. Long term, I would agree. I would love for that to be the case, that everything was included in the price of your dinner. That would be awesome. I think the misconception is a little bit you get there's waiter wages out there in the world. In New York City for years, it was at $2.13 an hour. And then the tips would make up the difference between, you know, often up to $50, $60, $70 an hour for a New York waiter. In our area, it's been minimum wage for quite a long time. Our waiters make $15, $45 an hour plus what their commission. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that work on commission, which is what our team does now, right? You work on Nordstrom, you work at a car dealership, you work, many places are on commission. And that's exactly what the model is that we're using. And I don't see why it's a whole lot different than tipping, other than that we do ask you or force you to do it, to pay it. So, but you don't go to a car dealership and ask your salesman to give you a smaller commission rate on the cost of your Chevrolet. That is not untypical.
But isn't the expectation, a lot of it is about expectations. So that a big reason, there are two reasons I tip. And one is that I figure, that person, they're working and they probably need the money more than I do, mm-hmm. and whether that's true or not. And the problem with that is I only have so much money. That's a kind of charity, if mm-hmm. you want to call it that. And I only have so much money to do that with. So I could take that money instead of tipping and just have cash in my car that I'm, because I do that too, right? I'm on the line at I-5. I'll give money away. Well, I could give more money away to people who could use it. So that's a little illogical to me that I tip for that reason. But the second reason is that I don't want to insult and ruin that person's day who feel, whether that's logical or not, I feel like it's a slap in the face to this person that I gave them nothing.
But do you actually vary your tipping at all?
I keep it pretty consistent. It's like, it's somewhere between 15 and 20.
Okay, so within,
but I'll round to something. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sit there and make them watch me do the math.
But you'll punish the waiter or the waitress or whatever if you feel like they didn't do a great job. Or do you just tip the same no matter what?
Yeah, to me, I probably should, but it's, the difference is so small in a good job and a bad job. I mean, it's really rare to me that somebody is just a horrible.
I ask it because I was reading about this earlier, and apparently most people think that they vary their tips, but they really don't.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tip 20% or 18% or whatever, you just pretty much tip 18 or 20% all the time.
That's just
regardless.
What you do, yeah. And when we did our research to decide, you know, what number was that service charge, we looked through all the credit card receipts for a year of business at all of our restaurants. And we came up with the fact that over 80% of the people tipped 20%. And over 80% of the people tipped on top of tax. So now we do our service charge on top of tax also before tax.
Before tax.
Because service charge is taxable event.
Right.
So that ends up being a wash.
Hey, we have one of those calls in defense of tipping. Lars in Bellevue, what's your story? Lars?
I think the benefits of capitalism. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, now. Go ahead.
Thank you. The benefit of capitalism is that you get paid more when you give more and provide more. When you sell shoes and you're paid under commission, you make more money. When I go to a restaurant, I would prefer to pay a tip and have better service and pay somebody 30% or 35% or 20% or 2%. So
do you think you get better service when the waiter thinks that a tip is hanging in the balance for you?
I don't know about that, but I do know that when I get good service, I ask for the manager and compliment him and give him a 30% tip, which encourages them to give better service. And when I get poor service, I say, I'm not giving you a tip, ask for the manager and tell him why. And I think there should be a direct correlation between their pay and their service.
Lars in Bellevue, thanks a lot. Tom, do you think that the staff worked harder when they felt like they could get it tipped for it?
We haven't noticed that at all. We've been doing this 2 years now, and like I said, our waiters are making the same or more than what they were making before the service charge. You know, like I said, if you don't like your dinner or you don't like your service, you don't pay for it at our restaurants. And so it really is exactly the same. They're on a commission. If they sell you an extra bottle of wine, say, or if they give you a particularly great wine service, whatever that is, they're making a commission on it. And it's no different than if your waiter talks to you about what's on the menu and sells you an extra appetizer, but you have to tip now more because your check is bigger. It is really no different.
So another famous local Seattle restaurateur, Renee Erickson, mm-hmm. told me she thought tipping is a sexist institution, mm-hmm. that it has promoted really bad behavior on the part of especially drunk customers over the mm-hmm. years. Have you noticed any change in your customers?
Well, the big change is that same customer now generally is the one who has an issue. If they're going to go there where they pinch a waitress's butt or a waiter's butt, if they're going to be inappropriate,
Just give less if the person's they don't think they're cute or something. Isn't that part of it too?
That's part of it too.
She's talking about genuinely bad behavior that's perpetuated because of the service fee, and the server just kind of in the past has just had to deal with it because they had to make their tips.
Right, exactly. Or they had to wear, you know, a certain time. Well, I don't want to say that, but I'm just saying that it does level the playing field, as I mentioned, kind of right off the bat. It levels the playing field no matter what color you are, whether you're gay or straight, whether you're a man or woman. It really is a more efficient way of handling that service. And at the end of the day, it's better for you, the customer. You don't need to tip 10%. If your service wasn't up to snuff, you don't need to sit there and stew and still have to tip. You don't pay anything. And I think that's a more reasonable way at the end of the day to solve the problem.
That's our time. Tom Douglas, is this going to be a non-issue because it's going to be robot servers within in 10 years?
No, definitely not. Service is an art. And I honestly believe that no matter whether it's a tipping or whether it's commission, you are working your craft, and it's an art. And I appreciate great service.
Restaurateur Tom Douglas, Dahlia Lounge, and so many others. Good to see you again, Tom.
Thank you so much, Bill.
KUOW's David Hyde, thanks for helping our listener, Derek, who wanted to know.
Thanks, Bill.
Whether we answer, I'd be curious to hear from Derek. You know, did you feel like you got... got an answer?
Help. Or if you've got questions or follow-up questions, you can see that form on our website.
Yes.
KUOW.org.
Our show made for you today by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.